Outside my window was a steeple with a clock that always said 12:30.
Mamas and the Papas there, who became a big part of that Southern California sound when they did indeed head to the canyon. The music scene of L.A. in the mid-60s is the subject of a brand new documentary called Echo in the Canyon. And we're pleased to be joined on the program by the director of the film, Andrew Slater. You had worked in the music business for a long time. You produced the Wallflowers' first album. You were president of Capitol Records. And so you were familiar with the music scene. But I understand that what really the impetus for making this movie was catching a showing on TCM of the Jacques Demy film Model Shop.
It was. You know, I think there's a point in everyone's life where sometimes you have to look to where you've come from to figure out where you're going to go next. And you know, that came for both Jacob and I at one point when we saw this film. And the film, it just reminded us of an innocent period in Southern California in the mid-60s. And for some reason, that inspired us to go back and look at the music that was, you know, really foundational at in Laurel Canyon. And we started looking at those bands and how they were more or less communicating between each other, and you know that led us to the songs to maybe cover and start to work on a record. And then there's always a story behind a song and people behind that story. And you know, we tried to make a film out of the research that we were finding.
So it was the efforts to put together the concert that really came before the film.
Well, it was more the exploration of the songs that provided the impetus for the film. The concert was just an exercise for us to try to do something more expansive with the film, which was, you know, to show you the recording of a song, and then in the middle of that song, you could be at the concert, and then you could be back to the recording of the song, and then you could see the author of the song sitting there reacting to it. So it was more of a vehicle in terms of an overall look of the film.
We've had Brian Wilson on our show, Jimmy Webb, and others who were a big part of that scene, and they talk about the sharing that went on among artists at that time period. And that's the echo. That's the echo that you speak about in the film, this idea that people in Laurel Canyon and in that L.A. music scene were open and wanted to share what they were doing and let our other artists hear it and contribute to it.
Well, I think it was a time of innocence and a sense of community. And I think that's one of the great things about having all of those immensely talented songwriters and singers in that place at that time. I mean, I think, you know, for a lot of those bands, they were looking at the Hard Day's Night and the life that the Beatles were sort of portraying in that film, and they came to California in search of that. And the bands had multiple singers and multiple songwriters, like Buffalo Springfield with Stephen Stills and Richie Furay and Chris Hillman and Neil Young, and they were sharing song ideas between them. And then across the street were, you know, people like Roger McGuinn and David Crosby. And so I think at that time also people weren't as concerned with the self and the idea of how much money could be made or you know, just the general nature of things that happen when an industry, you know, surrounds creative endeavors.
So was it more a healthy competition, or was it more finding inspiration when people would listen to a folk rock song and decide to incorporate that style, or when a Brian Wilson would hear Rubber Soul and then turn around and make Pet Sounds? Was it the competition, or was it really, oh, wow, I love that, I'm going to try that myself?
Well, I think probably a little bit of both, but clearly, you know, one has to be inspired before one creates. And when someone hears something that's a, you know, that's new idea that's an artful synthesis of two ideas, it, you know, it becomes the genesis for something new. And, you know, I think striving to be the best at what we're done in nature. So I feel like that's both elements we're really involved in.
Talking with Andrew Slater about his new film, Echo in the Canyon. Well, was it really the birds that issued the clarion call to everybody else to come out west?
Well, it really does start with Roger McGuinn and that 12 string. When he electrifies folk music and takes Pete Seeger's Bells of Rimney and turns that into his own interpretation, along with Turn, Turn, Turn and other beat poetry music, George Harrison hears that and he writes If I Needed Someone, which goes on Rubber Soul, which Brian Wilson hears, and he aspires to write Pet Sounds, which the Beatles hear, and they do Sgt. Pepper. And right there is the sort of bedrock for all of album music, you know, for the next 50 years.
How much of a role did Doug Weston and the Troubadour play in that sound?
Well, I think the Troubadour is something that's referenced in the film as a place where people, you know, went to obviously play. It was the beginnings of the folk scene, or one of the beginnings of the folk scene in California, that in the Ash Grove. But I think it's more closely associated with a later period of Laurel Canyon, you know, where it's about the singer-songwriter. Mm-hmm. And for us, there was really three periods of Laurel Canyon. There's the first period that we were focused on when there were bands coming to California emulating the Beatles. And then there's the psychedelic period, which is things, you know, get a little darker, and there's the riots on Sunset, and you have the Doors and Love and different bands like that. And then after that, there's a retrenchment, and, you know, it's more about sort of country music influences on rock. And as Beck says in the film, it's about the individual searching his own path, and Joni Mitchell, you know, shows up, and the bands become Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young instead of the Buffalo Springfield and the Byrds.
You're obviously telling a great story here, but also preserving history and seeing that already. One of the last, if not the last, interview that Tom Petty did. And how important is you to maintain history and tell the story of these people, some of whom are getting up there and may not be telling that story much longer?
Well, you know, really for us, it was about telling a story. And, you know, we love the music that those people made, and we love the people behind it, the ones that we know and have come to know personally. So the idea of making the film wasn't so much about being a historian or preserving anything. It was just about telling a story that was very important to us. And along the way, if that film becomes a document of that time, along with other great documents, you know, that's anything. That's the most any filmmaker could ask for.
This was your first film. Stylistically, you've done some things that I haven't seen the film yet, but from the trailer that I think are really interesting. Obviously, having Jacob there asking the questions adds a whole new level of authenticity and gets people to open up. But even the settings, too. You've gotten away from the standard documentary trope of a guy in a room with a green screen or a backdrop.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, for me, I have seen all of these films, you know, through the years, documentaries, and there's some great work by great documentarians. I mean, you know, no one could, you know, ever argue with, you know, the work of D.A. Pennebaker or, you know, Meisels. I mean, it's all great stuff. But for what I was looking to do was more to capture the thing that really changed my DNA, which was when I was in a movie theater. That was the first place I got to experience live music because I was too young to go to the places where these bands were playing. So in doing a film, one, I wanted to do things that were unique, like take you in the middle of a song to these various places, the studio, the live performance in front of the author. And also I wanted the people to look good because we revere them, and so many documentaries were capturing the information and doing it quickly because that's been, you know, sometimes it's the only way you can get the information. But I felt like in this particular instance, having been a journalist, I could never really write what I saw in people's faces when they were telling me a story. And I felt like in this film, if we were getting this personal, you know, look at two songwriters speaking, I wanted you to be able to hold on their face long enough and look at them and see them telling these stories. And so I just wanted everyone to look good. And, you know, they deserve to look good, and I'm glad you think they do.
Is there one song that really captures for you the time and the place better than any other?
Well, I think Expecting to Fly for me frames the film. Really, it captures, I think, in one sense, even in the title, you know, I think back in that period, no matter how outlandish people's dreams were, they felt like they could come true. And, you know, obviously we know through time that that kind of boundless optimism just doesn't last. And so the film begins and ends with that, you know, more or less. And I feel like that song is as an ending point for the film. Is about the loss of innocence, and it's about the loss of innocence in a relationship. So we were using it as a way to say that the end of this period of innocence, when all the bands came here, you know, was happening. And you know, maybe I think when Jacob sings "Bells of Rhythmia" and he sings, "Is there hope for the future in the beginning?" And you hear the opening notes of "Turn, Turn, Turn," which, you know, says there's a time for sort of everything. And we are sort of acknowledging that time. There's various little nods to the era and the ideas of that era.
Can there ever be another music scene like that? Has the internet killed that? Do we work in a different way than we did 50 years ago?
Well, I think that I think in some ways it's always there and it's always going to be there because people are going to share their ideas and they're going to create something different, in many cases, we hope, better by being inspired by other writers. The way we share things is different. You know, now people are a little more insulated, and they can record in their houses and trade files. And I think back then, one of the charming things about that sense of community is that if you were going to share an idea, you had to take your guitar and go across the street and knock on somebody's door and play it for them. And, you know, that's one of many ways you can do that now, but it's clearly not the only way.
How exciting was it for the artists like Fiona Apple, Regina Spektor, Cat Power, and the others to work with people that I'm sure they idolized growing up?
Well, I think you'd have to ask them. You know, clearly interpreting another artist's work that you admire brings a certain weight and responsibility, and I think all of those artists were immensely successful at honoring the work of the original writers of that material.
Well, I can't wait to see the film, getting wonderful reviews so far, and we're so happy that you were able to take a few moments and talk with us about it. Andy Slater, the film is Echo in the Canyon. We wish you much success with this, and thank you so much for visiting with us.
Oh, thank you.
Echo in the Canyon down at Railroad Square Cinema opens this weekend in Waterville, and I suspect we'll get into wider release as well, getting very good reviews. Looks terrific. And an interesting time in music history as well. Thanks to Andrew Slater, the director, for joining us.